This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll speak with our own Michael Smith about the Spanish edition of his book, Who Killed Che?
No longer can the CIA get away with the cover-up that it was the Bolivian government. We locate the murder of Che Guevara right in the White House and next door in Langley, Virginia.
We'll speak with the National Lawyers Guild attorney who's been on the ground in Ferguson, Missouri.
There are thousands of protesters, hundreds of lawyers and legal workers. This fight is continuing and continuing.
The architect of torture in Chicago, former police commander John Burge, was recently released from prison.
That fight continues because many of his victims are still behind bars, and there's legislation pending in the Chicago City Council to make things right.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Heidi, I just got back in the country and was quite disturbed to see what the bad guys in Pennsylvania are trying to do to muffle Mumia in the wake of Mumia's graduation speech at Goddard College in Vermont. And I understand there's going to be a vote on the law they've put forward to muzzle him. Can you give me an update on that?
Michael, you're referring to the proposed piece of legislation known collectively as the Revictimization Relief Act. It would allow district attorneys, the attorney general, and essentially victims of any personal injury crime to dictate what speech prisoners are allowed to engage in. And it would also target supporters who sponsored the speech. What led to this was Mumia Abu-Jamal gave an address at Goddard College, where he attended, recently. And lawmakers quickly jumped to create something called the Revictimization Relief Act, which would allow legislators to say if a family suffers emotional distress from a speech that, say, Mumia or another inmate might give or something they write, that they have the right basically to restrict the public hearing such speech. Of course, what this means is that public officials will be given unfettered discretion to determine what speech the public has a right to hear. And in the case of Mumia, I would not be at all surprised if this then curtailed his weekly radio shows and the many addresses that he gives to college campuses and to individuals around the nation.
What a horrible piece of legislation. Start with the fact that the victim here is Mumia. Now they're re-victimizing him. And it prevents people wrongfully convicted from speaking out about their conviction. It prevents people from learning about a wrongful conviction. It seems to me blatantly unconstitutional.
Well, let's talk about the Constitution, Michael. As you know, inmates do not always enjoy the full protection of the First Amendment. If corrections officials and others deem, and the Supreme Court has held this, what the speech they're engaging in may implicate a safety or a penological interest, so that they are allowed to restrict First Amendment rights of prisoners. Unfortunately, in my opinion, it shouldn't be held to a subjective standard, meaning because Mumia has such a lobby in the Fraternal Order of Police and Maureen Faulkner, the widow of Daniel Faulkner, the police officer whose shooting resulted in Mumia being incarcerated and on death row for so many years, I think the emotional factor weighs heavily, not only in bringing this legislation, but how it will be used going forward. And it's likely to pass.
Heidi, isn't it true that one of the principles of the First Amendment is that you cannot regulate or suppress speech on the notion that the audience finds it objectionable?
Certainly, Michael. And I think that those of us who are familiar with people who've engaged in activities or speech that is protected by the First Amendment know that so often it's things, you know, including symbolic speech like burning a flag, which is a protected First Amendment activity. So often that's what law enforcement will target based on its deemed offensiveness. But free speech is uncomfortable and should make us think about various viewpoints. Without that, we would have a pretty one-dimensional society.
I think we're heading in that direction. This is a really bad step backwards. What kind of forces are mobilizing against this?
Many groups supporting Mumia Abu-Jamal are on this, Michael. They've issued a statement. If you just put in Mumia Abu-Jamal on any search engine, you'll see links to statements that have been issued. And what I think is going to happen is the law will pass, and then we will have an outpouring by activists in response to this ill-advised legislation. So what they say, if you don't use the First Amendment, you risk losing it, I think applies here. It's time for people to really share their opinions about this in op-ed pieces, on the web, and in the streets.
Well, this is a story that's surely going to reverberate. Stay tuned.
Early October marked the 47th anniversary of the capture and assassination of Che Guevara in Bolivia. Two of our co-hosts, Michael Ratner and Michael Smith, authored the book Who Killed Che? How the CIA Got Away with Murder. And Michael Smith has just returned from a trip to Buenos Aires to promote the Spanish version of the book. Michael, you went to publicize the Spanish language version of this wonderful book. How did your trip go?
It was amazing, Heidi. I mean, I never dreamed that I'd get the attention and favorable reaction because, you know, we live here in the United States where people like us are pretty much ignored by the mainstream media. In Buenos Aires, they streamed in, interviewed me for 3 days straight, one interview after another, back to back. Almost all of them lasted for an hour. The interviewers, who were from like the Argentinian version of the New York Times or the Associated Press or the Sunday New York Times Magazine, they'd all read the book from cover to cover. They asked me intelligent questions, lobbed up a lot of softballs, and let me talk about the relevance of the book and explain how, really for the first time, as a result of Michael Ratner's good work, through a Freedom of Information request, we got the relevant documents from the CIA, the White House, the Defense Department, and the FBI, and were able to show with those documents and with the recent scholarship that's been done on Che, we were able to show that the cover story that the CIA had been putting out there for all these years, that they didn't want to kill Che, they just wanted to capture him and take him to Panama and interrogate him. That cover story is BS, and that the truth is demonstrated and documented in our book is that the United States government, in an operation that was organized out of the White House, and we've got documents on White House stationery, the United States government, with the help principally of the CIA, and the Green Berets who were brought in to train the Bolivian soldiers, and the intelligence that was provided by two CIA agents. It was the United States government that was responsible for the assassination of Che Guevara. And why was there such a grand reception for this book in Argentina? Because, as some of our listeners probably know, Che was Argentinian. He's the storied son of Argentina. He lived there for 25 years. I went to medical school just around the corner from my hotel. And after he graduated medical school, and by the way, he passed 10 medical school exams, studied fresh form, and passed 10 exams in 10 weeks. And he went to Guatemala afterwards in 1954 to get a job as a medical researcher. He couldn't get a job. He was there for 10 months. And finally, had to flee the country because the United States overthrew the reform government of Jacobo Arbenz in 54. Che got the hell out of there. And that was when they first opened up a CIA file on him, which became the largest file in the CIA building.
Michael, in modern day, I can imagine the government sending a drone to take out Che. But tell us how they tried to kill him. I understand there were almost 20 assassinations, attempts.
There were 19 successful, some unsuccessful attempts to assassinate foreign leaders by the CIA It was formed in 1947, the CIA was, to provide intelligence to the White House, intelligence, because the executive branch of the government felt that they were let down and didn't have enough intelligence to predict the Japanese bombing at Pearl Harbor in 1941. So the CIA was set up in 47 after the war to provide intelligence to the president. And the next year, they were allowed to do all these kinds of illegal things. Covert ops. And as a consequence of being given the green light to do illegal things, they had to develop a way to protect themselves. And they developed what they called the doctrine of plausible deniability, which is an Orwellian phrase for lying. They would deny their participation in the various illegal things that they did. They succeeded in killing the president of Vietnam, Diem, the head of the Congo, Lumumba. They attempted murder of 17 other people. It was a bad MO, but they would always deny it. The head of the CIA in 1975, Richard Helms, was questioned by the famous Church Committee, which was set up by the Senate to investigate the illegal actions of the CIA. And they asked Helms, they said, you know, do you ever tell the president about these assassinations? And Helms says, no, why would we want to embarrass a president? So they had a certain amount of autonomy, the CIA, even in the assassination of Che. At the end, when they finally succeeded in killing him, they denied that they did it.
And Michael, just remind us, why was Che so powerful in the eyes of the government? What was it that they felt he could have done that warranted this?
That's, of course, the central question. And to answer that fully, you have to talk about the success of the Cuban Revolution. The Cuban Revolution essentially meant that the Cubans took over control of their own economy. They succeeded in overthrowing an American-installed and supplied dictator, Batista, in 1959. The Batista forces killed 50,000 Cubans in the Cuban Revolutionary War. But finally, by 1959, with the central role played by Che, who joined the guerrilla forces as a doctor and quickly became a commander, and he and Camilo Cienfuegos led a column that cut the island of Cuba in half at Santa Clara. And once that happened, the Batista forces were finished, and Batista got on an airplane to the Dominican Republic, later retired in Miami. The revolutionaries had tremendous amount of support. They were headquartered in the Sierra Maestra Mountains, but they had a tremendous amount of support in the cities. There was a general strike that finally forced Batista out. When the revolutionaries marched into Havana on January 8th of 59. The first thing they did was they changed the law to allow Castro to become the prime minister because he was only 32 years old. And then the second law they passed was to grant citizenship to Che. And then the third law they passed, which Che wrote, was the Great Agrarian Reform Law, because heretofore the United States owned most of the land. And the life of a peasant working that land was pretty grim. No shoes, illiterate, disease, early death, hunger. They gave the land to the peasants that worked it. And they said to the United States, we'll pay you for the land, which is their right under international law, but we'll only pay you the amount that you've listed for tax purposes on what it's worth. So the United States said no. And the United States then retaliated against the Cubans by refusing to refine oil. So the Cuban economy was about to be shut down because they couldn't get any gasoline. So the Cubans nationalized the oil refinery. Then they nationalized the nickel mines, and they nationalized the phone company and the bus company and so on. That became the Cuban Revolution. The Cubans took over, to answer your question, they took over the running of their own economy. And that was the example that terrified the United States. So the United States tried to isolate the Cuban Revolution. They tried to get other countries in Latin America to go along with that isolation. And the countries that wouldn't go along paid a heavy price. In Bolivia in 1964, Brazil in 1964, the democratically elected governments of those two countries were overthrown with the support of Americans. In Chile, the famous other 9/11, you know, when Allende's socialist government was overthrown by the CIA and various American corporations. A military dictatorship was installed in Chile. And then in 1977, and this was what makes it relevant, particularly to Argentina, there was a military coup in Argentina. And the tyranny in Argentina lasted for 7 years. 30,000 people were disappeared and killed. And the trials of some of these generals that did this to the Argentinian people are still going on in Argentina, even when we were there 2 weeks ago. One of the reporters told me a funny joke. He said, "Why have there been no coups in the United States?" And I said, "I don't know." And he said, "That's because there's no U.S. embassy in the United States."
Well, let's talk about how the government coordinated this. You mentioned the White House. How did the CIA operate on the ground in Bolivia?
Well,
the
first
thing, Green Berets involved?
The Green Berets were central to the training of these. The Bolivian army was very weak. There had been a democratic revolution in 52, and the army was dissolved. So they were just kind of making a comeback, and they had no intelligence capacity. So what happened was, the CIA followed Che, like I said, from 1952 on, and it's a huge file. And when they finally figured out he was in Bolivia, a number of American generals and an admiral, don't ask me why an admiral, because Bolivia is a landlocked country, but they sent an admiral to Bolivia, and they signed a contract. It's in our book. It's called A Memorandum of Understanding. And the Bolivians agreed to supply the men and the space where they could be trained. And the United States agreed to do everything else. They supplied these guys with everything from bullets to breakfast. And they especially supplied them not only with training, but with intelligence. And the two guys that did the intelligence for the Bolivian army, who were dressed up as captains, Bolivian army uniforms, were Alberto Gonzalez and Felix Rodriguez, both sons of multimillionaire Cubans who fled along with Batista after the Cuban Revolution. And these guys signed up as contract agents for the CIA. In fact, it was Felix Rodriguez who figured out exactly Che's location. He was behind the lines because they were both allowed to go behind the lines and called in the Bolivian Rangers, who encircled him on October 8th and then killed him a day later. But the other thing that I think is important to mention is that Alberto Gonzalez, whose real name is Gustavo Villaldo, made a prior arrangement with General René Barrientos, the American-installed dictator. Oh, and incidentally, 21 of the top 23 Bolivian generals had been trained by the American Army in Panama at the School of the Americas, which the Latin Americans call the Escuela de Golpes, coup school. And 21 of these guys had been trained by the United States. They were totally in the pocket of the United States. So Gustavo Villaldo flies down to La Paz, gets off the plane. Carr takes him to the home of General Barrientos, the American-installed dictator, and he says to Barrientos, and this is all reported in Jorge Castaneda's book. Castaneda was a Mexican diplomat and professor at NYU, actually, and he interviewed Villaldo. And Villaldo told him, "Well, I showed up at Barrientos' house, and I said to him, 'General, if you capture Che, we would like him executed.' And the general said to me, 'I give you my word, as head of the Bolivian government, that if we capture him, we will summarily judge him and kill him.'" And that's, in fact, what they did. So there was a prior agreement. Although the United States had been trying to kill Che for years, they worked with a guy named Johnny Rosselli, who was the co-head, along with Sam Giancana, of the mafia in Chicago. And Rosselli got some poison pills from the CIA. They're not a James Bond, you know. And he gave them to this Cuban counter-revolutionary in Miami. He was supposed to go to Havana to poison Che, but the plan didn't work. And they later, the church committee questioned Felix Rodriguez. They said, "Is it true that you tried to kill Fidel Castro with an exploding cigar?" And Rodriguez said, "No, that's not true. But I did try to kill the son of a bitch with a high-powered rifle." One of the Argentinian reporters who had read Felix Rodriguez's autobiography, which I had also read, reminded me of the following story. The autobiography is called Shadow Warrior, the CIA Hero of 100 Unknown Battles. We'll talk about his heroes in a minute, but he told me the following story, that Rodriguez also worked for the CIA in Nicaragua to try to suppress the rebellion of the Nicaraguans against the American installed dictator there in the early 80s. And he captured and they murdered a woman, a commandante in Nicaragua. He stole her bra, and he has it in his house in a sort of a museum. He also has Che Guevara's Rolex watch, which Che had wanted to go to his son John, and he's also got one of Che's pipes.
Is the relevance of this entire history to Argentina today?
Yeah, I think we should conclude on that. I think that for young people in Argentina and throughout Latin America and really throughout the world, Che's an example of a person who not only wanted a more just world, but fought for it. And I think for Latin American countries, Che's example is now quite evident in the new spirit of independence and solidarity that these countries are showing. For example, 2 weeks ago, the American vulture funds who buy up very cheaply bonds of third world countries, and the vulture funds bought up the bonds of Argentina. This guy named Paul Singer, who runs one of these funds out of New York, bought up $1.3 billion worth of bonds for pennies on the dollar, and he's insisting that he get paid back 100 cents on the dollar, and he got Judge Thomas Grisey in the federal court here just down the block to say, yeah, you're entitled to that. Argentina, you can't pay back anybody else if you reach an agreement to take 30 cents on the dollar. You can't pay anybody until you pay Paul Singer 100% on the dollar. So the Argentinians brought a motion at the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva to condemn the United States. And to give you an idea of their solidarity and independence, the vote on the Argentinian motion was 30-5. Argentina was supported by Venezuela and by Brazil, the other two major countries in South America. And the United States was left isolated. The only support it got was from its rich friends, Great Britain, Japan, Germany, Czechoslovakia. There's a new spirit in Latin America, in these nations. When I was there, President Cristina Fernandez of Argentina said the United States is trying to destabilize our government. And she said, if I'm assassinated, don't look east, look north, because she's aware of this whole history of the CIA. Well, I don't think that they're going to assassinate her, partly because that she was brave enough to speak out against it. But the right-wing press in Argentina is trying to make fun of her about that. And the United States is widely hated there because they know that these vulture funds will have a human rights effect on their population. It takes money away from schools. It takes medicine out of hospitals. It destabilizes the government. It causes violence. It's a human rights issue. A guy named Bertram, who's the foreign minister of Argentina, made that point at the United Nations in Geneva. And the American delegate said, there is no connection between making them pay all their foreign debt and human rights. So that reminded me of when they said the New York dropped dead.
Michael, as we wrap up, let's conclude on a note of hope, and that would be Che's legacy, his relevance to young people, especially today.
Well, you know, I think that the reason Che is so well-known and revered is because of the situation that exists in the world, which is even worse today than it was when they killed him. That situation is captured beautifully by Victor Hugo, the French author, when he was talking about Jean-Paul Marat, who was also a doctor, French revolutionary that participated in the French Revolution in 1789. Victor Hugo, would you mind reading this, Heidi? Would you read what Victor Hugo said about Marat? Because it's relevant to why Che is so revered today.
They guillotined Charlotte Corday, and they said Marat is dead. No, Marat is not dead. Put him in the Pantheon or throw him in the sewer, it doesn't matter. He's back the next day. He's reborn in the man who has no job, the woman who has no bread, in the girl who has to sell her body, in the child who hasn't learned to read. He's reborn in the unheated tenement, in the wretched mattress without blankets, in the unemployed, in the proletariat, in the brothel, in the jailhouse, in your laws that show no pity, in your schools that give no future. And he appears in all that is ignorance, and he recreates himself from all that is darkness. Oh, beware, human society. You cannot kill Marat until you have killed the misery of poverty.
Viva Che.
Viva Che. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Last weekend, thousands of protesters in Ferguson, Missouri, just outside of St. Louis, demonstrated during a long-planned weekend of resistance to the militarized suppression of peaceful demonstrations against the killings of unarmed black teenagers, including Michael Brown, 2 months ago. Demonstrators traveled from cities across the country to participate in protests against police violence, including sit-ins and vigil marches. Meanwhile, National Lawyers Guild members have been providing legal support, legal observation, and felony representation for people arrested during the weekend. We catch up with St. Louis Lawyers Guild member, attorney Maggie Ellinger Locke, who has been working long hours representing arrested demonstrators. There are 90 municipalities in St. Louis, and Maggie also explains the challenges in helping those arrested get processed through a unique court system.
Maggie, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi.
I understand you've been on the ground in Ferguson, St. Louis for several weeks now, representing the National Lawyers Guild and our legal observers.
That's correct.
How has it been, and what's happening there?
Well, it's been an intense situation right from the very beginning. On August 9th, people poured into the streets after the killing of Mike Brown and have pretty much been occupying various locations around the St. Louis area in protesting ever since. We at the National Lawyers Guild have mobilized close to 100 legal observers at this point to come down and do the observing and training people who are local. We've also been connecting people who are facing felonies charges with representation, as well as backing up the Arch City Defenders who are handling the bulk of the municipal ordinance violation charges.
I assume, as a guild member, you've been to other demonstrations across the country. Give us a snapshot of the use of less lethal weaponry, chemical weapons. How's the level of police force been?
So particularly in August, it was very, very intense. There were lots of chemical weapons used, tear gas every night. I myself was tear gassed multiple times. It's no fun. Another major mobilizations that I've been to, they last a couple of days, maybe the duration of a week, but this has been continued onslaught of less than lethal weapons that they've been using. So it's been a kind of a different switch from that. It's definitely been a marathon and not a sprint.
Did they have a long-range acoustic device there?
They've had many, yes. They've used them multiple times in different locations. Different agencies have them. There are a lot of different agencies on the ground for law enforcement. The Missouri State Highway Patrol, St. Louis County Police Department, the Sheriff's Department, and of course we have 90 different municipalities in St. Louis County, each with its own police force. So there's been a lot of different weapons used by different agencies.
How do you explain the marathon character of this repression?
Well, I mean, it's just a direct response to the repression by the state on to the people of St. Louis City, St. Louis County, particularly North County. This has been ongoing for a very, very long time here in St. Louis, and we're just now, I think the rest of the world is starting to hear about it. This is what it takes to fight back. The people are out there every day on the streets.
How do you explain the willingness of people to be so resilient, you know, digging in the long term, and this broad support they're getting? It's really phenomenal.
It absolutely is. It's been really, really inspiring for me. I think it's just what's required. You know, this is about necessity. People are being killed walking down the street all the time. It's going to take this kind of turnout and this kind of resistance in order to fight back.
Maggie, do you reside in the area?
Yes, I do. I'm from the St. Louis area.
And so I assume legal observers and other legal support members have traveled from around the country.
That's right. We've had NLG members pour in from all over, which has been really fun, frankly, to getting to know all these people. We were calling it Activist Summer Camp initially. Now it's Activist Autumn Camp. I mean, you know, this is still ongoing, and we still have folks who have been leading us and helping to lend support and building a structure that we can really use to kind of coordinate the legal response team on the ground.
A question, though, about the local merchants, the business people. When national special security events come to town, they're often fear-mongering tactics by law enforcement, you know, that anarchist disruptors will come to town. How is the response from the people who live there and the business persons, especially the financial industry? Are they boarded up? Are they adding the private security details? Have you seen any of that?
I've seen a little of that, yes. St. Louis community, including the business community, is really stratified. It's a mixed bag. So Monsanto Corporation, which is based in Creve Coeur, Missouri, actually made a donation recently of $1 million to various community groups doing work on the ground. On the other hand, we'll have a local pizza company board up its windows, and then the owner will train a gun on protesters in an effort to intimidate them. So it's been kind of across the board. There was an action, it went quite viral, so you may have heard about it, at the St. Louis Symphony recently, where protesters stood up and started singing, "Which Side Are You On?" and changed lyrics a little bit. That's very much a white, upper-middle-class group of individuals who were targeted there at the symphony, and it was overwhelmingly positive. There were a few people in the audience who were not supportive at all, but I'd say the bulk of the audience was. It's hard to say. There'll be confrontations at the Rams and Cardinals games, and then you'll have a lot of support from folks you wouldn't necessarily expect.
Maggie, what are the demands that are being raised, and how has the organization manifested itself around those demands?
The demands have been varied depending on which group of individuals is calling for them, but there are a couple clear ones that have emerged as strong themes. Indicting Darren Wilson, the officer who shot Michael Brown, is at the very top of everyone's list. In order to achieve that, we'll have to have demand number two met, which is that Bob McAuliffe, the St. Louis County prosecuting attorney, would recuse himself from this case. People believe he's been conflicted and that his father was a white police officer who was shot by an African-American man and killed. And another big demand is that all of these many municipal charges that people are facing be dropped. And there may be some headway on that. And in addition, we really desperately need reform of our municipal court system. The structure's insane, frankly, and so that's a common demand as well. But they have varied.
Maggie, have any of the attorneys or legal observers been arrested?
Yes. We've had, well, actually, we just had a law professor who's been a legal observer arrested Monday night, most recently. But in total, we've had 6 legal observers arrested.
What's different about the court system in St. Louis from other courts across the country?
In 1861, the city of St. Louis and the county of St. Louis split from each other and have never reunified. The reason for the split was there were tax reasons. Although there have been attempts at reunification throughout the years, they have never been successful. Since that time, the county of St. Louis has fractured and many times over. There are now over 90 municipalities plus areas of unincorporated St. Louis County as well. Each of these tiny little municipalities, which can range from 12 people up to 50,000, have their own unique court system, their own police force, their own municipal code, and they are not consistent. So it can be a nightmare for certainly attorneys trying to navigate the system. But for defendants, what this can mean is that if you are facing charges in one municipality and you're being, for example, held there, you can sometimes be held up to a month waiting for the next municipal court to come and pick you up to attend its court date because these municipalities are so tiny, we don't have court very frequently. So we've got a lot of unusual ways of operating here in order to kind of deal with this situation. We have a lot of inconsistent rules spread across these municipalities that are often in contradiction with each other, and it can be very confusing and frightening for anyone involved with the system.
Well, if nothing else, this should provide a welcome opportunity to call for reform of such an antiquated and confusing system.
Absolutely, and that's exactly what the protesters are doing. I would add as well, one thing that we're hoping locally with the Guild to do is use this as an opportunity to demand jury trials for these municipal ordinance violators, or alleged municipal ordinance violators. Yeah. We've been denied that for a number of years here in the metro area, even though we are entitled to it under Supreme Court operating rules. So we're hopeful that if we can demand jury trials for all of these protesters who've been arrested, we may in fact be able to crash the system and really get some of that reform that's so desperately needed.
We're talking with Attorney Maggie Locke, who is a National Lawyers Guild member and is representing a lot of the protesters in Ferguson. Now, Maggie, what are the next steps for the movement down there?
Well, right now, everyone's kind of recovering from this weekend of resistance that we just had with close to 100 arrests and dealing with the aftermath of that. And we're starting to gear up for what everyone expects will, when the grand jury does not return an indictment against Aaron Wilson. We are worried that the city may erupt in protests, and we want to be prepared for that. So right now, coming up with emergency action plans and gearing up towards that.
Are you seeing disproportionate charges such as excessive bail or incite to riot, that kind of thing? Any terrorism-related charges?
There have been no terrorism-related charges, no federal charges. But we've had 40 people now who are facing felonies, some of which did not survive a preliminary hearing, so those are concluded. But initially, the police response was one of aggression, a physical response. Then they, after coming under national and international scrutiny through the media, toned back some of their tactics, and they've now been using the court system to impose excessively high bonds and increasingly more difficult to fight charges. So they're shifting tactics, which means we have to shift tactics as well. But they're definitely responding to us.
Maggie, so often we see individuals who are deemed to be leaders or organizers targeted by the FBI and other intelligence agencies for special treatment. Have you had any indication of that? Any word that agents have visited families or friends of certain people, sort of pinpointing specific individuals?
We absolutely believe that people have been under surveillance for some time now. There have been some visits, yes.
What about the national impact of these magnificent demonstrations? What's its relationship to the national movement against police brutality?
Well, it certainly has shone a spotlight on police brutality nationwide and mass incarceration. I think that this is an excellent opportunity for activists on whatever issue to build and deepen their analysis on whatever they're fighting on. This impacts everybody. And I think that the protesters have really demonstrated that in a way that has been effective towards building a national consciousness, towards ending this system of repression.
And Maggie, I'm not sure how it's set up with the different municipalities, but is there one defender agency or several, and are they devoting resources to defend individuals arrested?
So by statute, the public defender's office cannot represent anyone facing a municipal ordinance violation. So it falls on private attorneys primarily to, you know, provide that work. Now, there's a nonprofit locally called the Arch City Defenders who has stepped up and is doing amazing work to represent many of these alleged violators, and they're primarily funded through the city of St. Louis. But it definitely comes down to local attorneys stepping up and willing to take on these cases.
Maggie, is there a website that our listeners can go to keep in touch with the developments down there?
Well, the national NLG.org has some information that's been updated pretty consistently. You know, we don't have a legal website locally to follow. I can tell you that the Organization for Black Struggle and more, Missourians Organizing for Reform and Empowerment, both have websites and have been two of the most key groups that have been organizing on the ground. And if you want more information, I would encourage listeners to seek those two websites out.
Maggie Ellinger-Locke, it's been a pleasure to have you with us on Law and Disorder, reporting from the ground in St. Louis. We want to thank you for your efforts.
Stay safe and stay strong.
Absolutely. And thank you both for having me.
We look forward to staying in touch. Thanks.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Bye-bye.
Bye, Maggie.
Last week, former Chicago Police Commander John Burge, who was convicted of lying about torturing and then falsely imprisoning more than 100 African-American men at a West Side Chicago police station, will be released from the Butner Correctional Institution and reporting to a halfway house in Tampa, Florida, where he lives on Chicago taxpayers' pension. This has been an ongoing story that we've been reporting for many years with the principal attorney for the victimized men, Flint Taylor, who's a partner at the People's Law Office in Chicago. We talk about why John Burge was released and Flint's recent article entitled "John Burge, Torturer of Over 100 Black Men, is Out of Prison After Less Than 4 Years." Flint reminds listeners that the total in financial damages to taxpayers from the torture of over 100 people that Burge oversaw is in excess of $120 million and continuing. These payments from Chicago taxpayers go for legal defense fees for the torturers, their pensions, which they're still getting, and the damages awarded to the injured men. Attorney Flint Taylor joins us today on Law and Disorder.
Flint, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Heidi. It's good to speak with you again, and Mike as well.
Flint, John Burge just got out of prison down in Florida. He's in a halfway house now in Tampa. Did about 4.5 years. You helped put him there. Can you give us, in a nutshell, the background to the Burge imprisonment? And then what we really would like to talk about is what we can do from here on out to help other victims of Burge.
Well, Burge is a now notorious police torturer here in Chicago. He shot from detective up to commander of a police station based on torturing African-American suspects into giving confessions and sending many of them to death row and to life in prison. Ultimately, we were able to, along with community activists, expose this pattern and practice of 100 cases of police torture. This was by electric shock, by bagging people, and by other kinds of racist brutality. And we exposed it, and nothing happened for many years, partly because the mayor of the city, who was Richard Daley, who was previously the prosecutor, chief prosecutor, refused to prosecute Burge, but rather used the confessions to put men in the penitentiary. But ultimately, the feds indicted Burge several years ago, not for torture, because the statute of limitations had run on that, but rather for perjury and obstruction of justice. And a la Al Capone, he was convicted by a predominantly white jury and ultimately sentenced to 4.5 years in the penitentiary in Butner. After 3.5 years, this past October, he was permitted to go to a halfway house for 6 months. So the question that remains here in Chicago is, what's happening now? What's happening with regard to the men who are still in the penitentiary decades later? And there are almost 20 of them based on tortured confessions. And how about the men who testified against Burge, who stood up against Burge, who were his victims, starting in 1973 and going all the way to 1991. Those men, unlike Burge, who gets a pension now, and the Illinois Supreme Court has upheld his right, even as a convicted felon, to collect that money as he walks prison, these men get nothing, have nothing. Because of the statute of limitations in the civil cases, they haven't been able to collect a dime. And there are as many as 90 of those men on the streets of Chicago with no health care, with no treatment for psychological damage, for no job training, all of that. So at this point, we're raising the question, and we have an ordinance before the city council that a majority of the council members support at this point, to have reparations for those men. The reparations for those men would be in the tune of $20 million, the same amount of money the city has spent to defend Burge in the cases of the exonerated men. That money would go to help the men in their fight for justice, and at the same time, we are seeking hearings on behalf of the men who are still in the penitentiary on the basis of tortured confessions. So at this point, despite the fact that Burge has been convicted, he has now come out of jail, collecting his pension to go back to Florida with his boat, the vigilante, while the men, many of the men are still in prison who were tortured by him, and the ones who aren't, most of them have not collected a nickel for their torture.
Flint, in addition to Burge, aren't the collaborating officers who helped with the torture also receiving pension payouts?
Yes. The total amount of money that the city and the county and the state has paid in the Burge torture scandal amounts to $120 million and still counting. The cabal of predominantly white detectives and officers who worked for Burge and tortured with him, they're mostly all retired now. And when we compiled how much their pensions are, it was another $20 million. So that's over $40 million the city has paid to defend Burge and to give pensions to Burge and his men. And then there are about 18 men who, because they have been fully exonerated, were able to bring lawsuits. And the city and the county and the state have paid over $65 million in compensation to those men. That's how we get to the number of $120 million. As I said, however, the vast majority of the tortured men have not been fully exonerated, and so they do not have the right to bring lawsuits. And that's why we're seeking reparations for them. That's why we have this ordinance in front of the city council. And that's why we picked the $20 million as a commensurate amount of money to spend not only for some kind of compensation for the men who were tortured, but also to set up a community center on the south side where there could be treatment for these men, and also education, a place they could get together. We also are seeking free education in the city system for them, job training, as well as that the issue of torture be fully and honestly taught in the public schools of this city as perhaps the most significant police scandal in the history of the city.
Flint, when you say we, who are the forces involved with you that are organizing around these very reasonable demands?
Well, we is of course the lawyers at the People's Law Office. It's a group of activists that over the years have fought these various issues and continue to fight them. At the forefront right now is a group called the Chicago Justice Torture Memorial Project, and we are fighting for this ordinance. And there's been a lot of important politicking, as it were, going on, particularly with regard to progressive and African-American and Hispanic aldermen and women to get their support on this ordinance. We're now at a very sensitive stage where the mayor has had to come out, Emmanuel, no friend to the anti-torture forces, and he's been asked repeatedly, what's your position on this? And, of course, in Chicago, the mayor controls much of the politics of the city council. And he is hemmed and hawed, and he has played both sides against the middle. But it's time right now where he's going to have to fish or cut bait, and he's either going to have to support this ordinance or have to face a full hearing on it and the wrath, particularly of the African-American community, at a time when he stands for re-election in February.
Flint, how old is John Burge now, and how's his health?
Well, he's, I believe, 66 or 67 years old. He's not in good health. He's a broken man in a lot of ways, not unlike some of the Klansmen who it took decades to chase down and to get convicted in the South for the atrocities that they committed, the church bombings and the killing of the civil rights workers in the 60s. So in some ways, he's kind of a caricature of his former robust, torturing self. But he is symbolic. But he, of course, is only part of the issue and part of the scandal. And as I said earlier, it goes all the way to former Mayor Daley. It goes to many of the police superintendents that covered this up and participated in it. And it goes to all the prosecutors involved who took the tortured statements, the judges who permitted this to go on, knowing full well that the evidence coming in front of them was, in fact, truthful and in fact raised a question of human rights violations and crimes against humanity. So it is a tremendous scandal here. It has spanned more than 40 years. Unless we get this reparations ordinance passed, and until and unless the men who are still in prison get full and fair hearings where they can air out their torture allegations, and until and unless we have federal and state statutes that make torture a federal crime with no statute of limitations so that the Burge situation cannot replicate itself, we will not have justice in this scandal, and the conscience of the city with regard to the police torture scandal will not be cleansed.
Beautifully said, Flint, and so true.
Thank you. So there's a great group of people still fighting this issue here in Chicago, and it's something that needs to be heard across the country. We see that Rahm Emanuel was just quoted in Panetta's book about how he tried to suppress the evidence of torture under the Bush administration. So, as I said, he's no friend of people who are fighting against torture, but he also has a very sensitive situation in this city because the African-American community, which supported him in the past because he was in the Obama administration and a key henchman for Obama, have come to see him as someone who has shut down schools and otherwise been no friend of the African-American community. So he needs to give more than the appearance of caring about the African-American community. We have the strong support of Karen Lewis, who was a wonderful challenger and she has now had to withdraw from the race because of health issues. She seemed to be mounting a campaign that would be similar to Harold Washington back 30 years ago, but she's been stricken with a serious illness and has had to withdraw in the last week. And she was a strong supporter of the reparations ordinance. It's a personal tragedy as well as a political tragedy here in the city of Chicago.
We've been speaking with Flint Taylor, a partner at the People's Law Office, a stalwart in the fight against torture in Chicago. Flint, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Flint.
You're welcome, and it's good to speak with both of you. It's a wonderful show, and I look forward to speaking with you again as things develop here what the people in New York like to say is the second city, but people here look at it otherwise.
I was born in Chicago. Take it easy,
Take care, Flint.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
In the evening, baby, when the sun goes down. In the evening, when the sun goes down, sure gets no time when your baby's not around. Sleeping on